Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Tonight's guest was scheduled to be tax accountant Anne Freed Lefton. Anne needed to reschedule, so she's not here tonight. We'll be here in early August. We scurried around and asked two other great guests to be on the show, and they couldn't make it either. We're down to plan D, and that's to interview the host. So tonight I'm going to be interviewing Michael Shackelford and finding even more about his background. On last week's show, we addressed an email sent to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com about a maybe malfunction on a blackjack game. Basically, the dealer had an ace up, checked for blackjack, and the game continued. The player ended up with a multi-card 21, and then the dealer discovered that she did indeed have a blackjack. Somehow the mirror that she was using didn't quite work. The house took the player's money. Both Michael and I agreed that this was a correct ruling. We got two separate emails from players who told me they had very similar cases that they were involved in. And in both cases, the house pushed with the players. The house did not keep the money. So now I think this is a smart thing for a casino to do PR-wise, but I don't think they were required to do so. But you might want to ask, because you could get lucky.
Yeah, I agree with you, and casinos will do that. Sometimes they think we're absolutely right about this, but the player feels very strongly that he's right, and we don't want to lose, we don't want to risk losing his business, so we're just going to take it on this one and give him what he wants. And sometimes that's the right business decision, but for some unknown player, no, I would have said the dealer had blackjack, you lose, sorry.
Now, were you answering that as a co-host or as a guest?
Both.
Okay, good. Trick question. All right, now we're nearing the final stages of the World Series of Poker and have some interesting things to talk about in the poker world. The $1 million entry fee charity tournament, the big one for one drop, ended just a few days ago with Antonio Esfandiari taking home the $18 million first prize. This has gotten publicity in other places, so other than congratulations, Antonio, That's not what we're going to talk about here. Earlier in that same event, a Russian poker pro named Mikhail Smirnov actually discarded four of a kind. The betting patterns led him to believe that an opponent had a straight flush, so he pitched his mere quads face up to the shock and the amazement of the other players at the table. On cardplayer.com, when players were discussing, they were split about 50-50 whether this was a very reasonable move for him to make or a gargantuan mistake. With the best players leading towards, it was probably a good move. The entire process was filmed, and we'll see it on the TV. Apparently, it's supposed to be starting to be aired at the end of July. Then we'll know for sure whether it was a very smart move or a gargantuan mistake. Do you have any thoughts on this area, Michael?
Yes, I put up a poll on my Wizard of Vegas site about this, and currently 22 people thought he should have called, and one person thought folding was the right play. Now, let's say that the guy does not have a straight flush. It's not necessarily a gargantuan mistake, in my opinion. It's all about probabilities. And perhaps the player who folded could argue that, you know, I felt the probability that he had a straight flush was this, and I was wrong. And so I'm not going to come down on him if it wasn't a straight flush. But it will be very interesting to see what it was. And I want to go on record that I say that I don't think he had the straight flush.
All right. If I take the yes on that, what kind of odds are you going to give me? I have no inside knowledge, and we won't know until the end of July at the earliest.
Just off the top of my head, I'd offer you even money.
Offer.
You could take that or renegotiate later.
Well, even money is not an attractive offer for me. So I either will renegotiate later, or you can stick it. One of the two. All right. The second place winner in the one drop tournament was Sam Trickett, who's a pro from England, I think. He won more than $10 million for his efforts. But then he had the hell beaten out of him afterwards by six guys. His girlfriend was roughed up a bit, too. This is very rare in Las Vegas, and it bothers me a lot. It apparently wasn't a robbery attempt. It was just a serious beating. Now, in the old days of Vegas, if the mob thought maybe the fix was in a race or a game or something, they might react this way if something didn't stay fixed. But in Vegas today, it doesn't happen. This is very upsetting, and this is the last thing Vegas needs. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, too. It reminds me of a similar beating at the MGM Grand that was just for the kicks of it. And I hope they catch whoever did it, and they do a long time in jail.
I do, too. The last piece of poker news, Ray Bitar, who was the CEO of Full Tilt Poker, who was indicted on Black Friday, which was April 15, 2011, he flew from Dublin to New York in order to surrender to the United States authorities and plead not guilty to all the charges. The Fed says thank you very much and immediately slapped additional charges onto the indictment. Now, Full Tilt still owes U.S. players something like $350 million. So this is money that should be floating in our gambling economy and isn't. So let's hope this is a latest step into getting this resolved, finally. All right. So now is the time that Shaq changes his co-host hat for an interviewee hat. Michael Shackelford is Southern California born and bred, receiving his college degree in math and economics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. This is a very good school, although having a Pacific Ocean beach right on campus and seeing girls in bikini tops on campus all day long might be a distraction to lesser mortals. By profession, Shaq is an actuary, which is a fancy term for math geek. For more than 15 years now, Michael has been applying his mathematical skills towards analyzing gambling situations. And much of this, he makes it available to all of us for free. Michael Shackelford, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Can't tell you how happy I am that you're here tonight. All right. So first of all, Michael, what makes your Wizard of Odds website unique?
I would like to say that my website is the website to go to for the whole gamut of casino games, like they say in the introduction, especially the obscure ones. If there's some new game that just came out recently, I would like to think that I'm on top of it and I'm the one who wrote to it first. But it's not like I ignore the common games either. Name any game and I think I have just a ton of material about the game. And I like to think that I present it all in a way that the average person can understand, and hopefully they'll learn a thing or two, and I'm making better gamblers out there.
All right. Now, the main sponsor of your website is Bovada. It used to be called Bodog, or different branch of the same company, rather than have a lot of smaller sponsors. Is this working out well?
It is. Michael Bluejay, who was on our show about 2 months ago, was my advertising man at the time, and he had the idea to try this out. Let's just have one single advertiser and be very loyal to them and promote the heck out of them, and maybe we'll make more money. And if it doesn't work out, we can always go back to the old model. So we had an auction for who was going to be the one advertiser. And it wasn't just the highest bid wins. They had to be a legitimate casino that we approved of. And it was basically between two and Bodog won. And this was back around 2007 or so. So they have been the only sponsor on the site for years. And that kind of long-term loyalty is not often seen in the online gambling world. And it's been, who knows what would have happened had we never thought of this. But I've been very happy with the results with this model. And we're not planning to change it.
All right. For a while, you were an adjunct professor at UNLV. How long did you do that? And what did you teach?
I taught a course in gaming mathematics. There is a whole major at UNLV on hotel and casino management, and they believe correctly that people in the casino business should understand the basics of the games in the casinos and a little bit about math. So this is a required course in this line of study, and I taught it twice. I taught it 1 year, and then I came back and taught it again a couple years later, and then they found a permanent professor to do it, so that's why I'm not doing it anymore.
If they asked you back, or is it something that you're interested in?
Not really. I'm running so busy right now, and UNLV is really far from my house, and they do not pay very well.
Well, maybe they can move the campus for you. What do you think?
Sure.
Good.
Then I'll do it.
All right. Now, knowledge-wise, do you consider yourself more of a gaming analyst or a gambler?
A gaming analyst. I love gambling, but I think I love analyzing games even more. And even when I was a kid, I read through John Scarney's books just because I was fascinated with the mathematics of gambling. And after I finished with the actuary exams, I suddenly had a lot of spare time in my schedule. So I spent that resuming it, but using my more advanced math skills to analyze games I wasn't capable of analyzing before. And so after I did all this analysis, just for the pure fun of it, that's when the internet came along, and I thought, you know, there's no good websites about gambling out there. I think I'll just throw all this out there just as a public service and see what comes of it.
Well, good. A lot of good things have come up. It was so good you qualified to be a host on the radio. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
Now, what gambling games have you at least been a low-level expert at?
It's not that I just analyze games, but I also consider myself a pretty good gambler. I don't do it on a daily basis like you do, but when I first came to Vegas, I did a lot more of it. I first started out as a blackjack player. I was counting cards. I learned to do that back in college and kept on doing that, and I still do it once in a while. Certainly played a lot of video poker, in large part thanks to you. I also really got into sports betting, and that's one of the few things that I still do. And another thing that I did was playing in a lot of blackjack and baccarat tournaments. And I think I talked about this in one of the previous interviews, but for their high-limit table game players, all the strip casinos will have free blackjack and baccarat tournaments and sometimes other games. And I think that I'm much more skilled than the average player. I know a thing or two about proper tournament strategy. So let's say that there's a $300,000 tournament and they invite 100 people. That has a value of $3,000, assuming everyone has the same chance. But I think my chances are at least twice that of the average person, so that makes it worth $6,000 to me. And I will give the casino some action on a game with as low of a house edge as I possibly can to make them happy and invite me to these things.
Very good. We actually have two guests in the works who are table game tournament specialists. So you should be hearing more about that aspect. We did have Stanford Wong on the show talking about his book on tournament casino strategy. or casino tournament strategy. But we have two guests probably in the near future who will be on. All right. Now, a couple weeks ago when Jason Bean was on, you indicated that you regularly donate to him at poker. Would you consider yourself a low-level poker expert or at least knowledgeable about that?
I think that I'm just knowledgeable about poker. I think I'm the only person out there who claims to not be a good poker player. And, you know, I think that I could go to a low-limit game in any casino and at least stay above water. But my circle of friends here in Vegas are a bunch of professional gamblers. And so I invite them all over to my house, and they drink my beer and eat my food and take my money. And
they leave your wife alone, don't they?
Yes. Okay. At least they do that.
Okay, good.
So, but, you know, I think that I learn a thing or two from these poker games, and I consider, and if I lose money, I consider it a cost of a little entertainment.
Did you ever gamble at backgammon?
One of my friends in this circle is very into backgammon, and I play him once in a while. I'm climbing Mount Whitney with him, by the way, next week.
Oh, and it's your 10-year-old.
I'm going with a friend and his son as well, and this particular person is really into backgammon, and it would not surprise me at all if he lugs his backgammon set up there to play backgammon with me. So, yes, I do play backgammon, and I think that I'm pretty good at it. For a while, I was really into it, and I got the Snowy software, and I was somewhat addicted to it, as I must have played, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day against Snowy, and I read through quite a few backgammon books, and I don't, but I still, I was just, I don't know. I never got to the level where I needed to get to really take it seriously. I kept track of all my games against Snowy, which is backgammon software. And it was clear that Snowy was just significantly better than me. And so, you know, one day I just got frustrated with it and quit cold turkey.
Huh. Well, my backgammon days were considerably before Snowy came about, so you're actually likely better than me at this point. So if you and I ever played, I would insist that you played left-handed.
I'll give you that.
All right. So now you have a couple of off-the-wall skills. Two in particular are juggling and riding the unicycle, maybe both at the same time. How did you get into those things?
Those skills are highly correlated, by the way. Lots of people that juggle also ride the unicycle. And I think it's in the circle that I run in with a lot of people that are not necessarily gamblers, but just people that are good at math and computer programming, you find an awful lot of jugglers for some reason. And if there's a really good PBS show about the modern computer age, and one point or one story it keeps coming back to is the Stanford Juggling Club and how all the huge billionaires in computers today formed relationships and friendships at the Stanford Juggling Club. And this does not surprise me a bit. There's just something about the human brain that if you're good at math and computers, somehow you just also seem to have a good skill for juggling and music as well. So and if you go to a juggling club, you will see the converse. You will see a lot of very geeky guys that are good with math and computers. So I think that I'm just one of these people that has that skill, and I enjoy doing it. I'm rather rusty at it. When I lived in Baltimore through the 90s, I did quite a bit of juggling and unicycle and was pretty serious about it.
If things go bad in the gambling world, you can take off your hat, put it on the ground, and hope many people put money in it while you juggle and unicycle.
Yeah, and you never see these street entertainers in Las Vegas doing juggling. So I wouldn't mind trying that just for the fun of it, just to see how much money I make.
Interesting. Now, would you say, now in my mind, I would like put magicians in that same family of people, the people who do magic and the people who do juggling and stuff.
So would I.
Okay.
And it kind of like Howard on the Big Bang Theory. He's very into magic, and I am too. I I think I could consider myself an amateur magician, and sometimes for my kids' birthdays, I will put on a magic show for them and all their friends, and that's something I like too.
Do you put on a clown suit when you're doing it?
No, but sometimes I'll put on kind of like a wizard suit.
A wizard suit.
Yes, and I may have talked about this before, but on my website I have some gambling videos, and one of the most popular ones is one time we sent out the dealer who I hired for these videos to go get lunch, and he took a long time because he got lost. So I told Angela, my student and the cameraman, let's just make a video of a magic trick to kill some time. And so we did a quick one of my favorites, and this one is the second most popular of all of the videos that I put up there on YouTube.
Huh, very good. It's not the one you cut Angela in half, though, is it? No, you never did that, maybe.
No, it's a simple card trick.
All right, so you used to work for the Social Security Administration.
Yes.
Now, that was a significant part of your life, was for that. And when, so the most enduring accomplishment, which at that time appeared to be something to do with baby names. How did that all come about, and what is that?
Okay, yeah, I spent much of my young adult life working for the Social Security Administration. Fresh out of college, I graduated in 88, which, much like now, is a horrible time to graduate from college. The economy was really bad, and no one seemed to be in the mood to hire somebody who had no experience whatsoever. And one day, the summer after I graduated, I was reading through the newspaper for the classified ads, as I did often, and there was an ad saying, federal government is hiring college graduates. Start out by taking this basic skills test. So I called up the number and asked to take this test, and drove up from San Diego to Long Beach to take this test. And if I can toot my own horn, I'm pretty good at taking tests.
You'd have to be to get through the actuary exam.
Yes. I like tests, and I think that there's sort of an art to a good test. And I enjoy trying to get into the test maker's head and therefore try to get at what is the kind of answer they want to see. So I took this test and did very well on it. And so I get a call saying that, would you like to come in for a job interview with the Social Security Administration? And if you say no, we are going to remove you from our list. So I said yes. And I got a job.
Because you wanted the job, or because you did not want to be removed from the list?
Yeah, I took the interview because I did not want to be removed from the list. I at this point, any job was looking like something that I wanted to do. So I went to Huntington Park, California, which is near East L.A. It's a very Hispanic part of the L.A. area. And I took a job interview for basically a claims adjuster. So when you come in and apply for disability, survivor's benefits, or retirement, you'll be sitting across from what they call a claims representative. And they're going to ask you a bunch of questions and ask you for a bunch of documents. And they're going to be the ones to process all this information and either deny you or approve your claim. And it sounds simple enough, but disability claims can be very complicated and involve folders and folders of paperwork. And so I went through their training course, and I did this for about a year and a half and got terribly bored with it. I definitely felt it was not my calling. And I kept asking, you know, there must be jobs in the Social Security headquarters for actuaries or something like that, some bean counters where I can use the mathematical skills that I learned in college that were being totally wasted as a claims representative. And I met the right person, and she said, oh, yeah, you should call someone named Harry Ballantyne. He's the chief actuary there in Baltimore. So I gave him a call, and he was overjoyed to take this call because the federal government by this time was in a hiring freeze, but they could promote from within, and they wanted some more actuaries. They couldn't hire off the street, so they were more than happy to take me. So they made me, compared to what I was making at the time, a very good offer, and they moved me out to Baltimore. So I worked as a Social Security actuary for a while. I know this is a long answer, sorry, but it's in a big part of my life. And so I worked there at the Social Security headquarters in their actuarial department for 8 years. And it was primarily my job to do estimates on congressional legislation affecting Social Security. And the hot button issues at this time through the Clinton years were eliminating the earnings test, which at the time, if you were over 65 and you kept working, you were allowed to make so much money, but after that, they would cut your benefits for it. And there was a lot of call to repeal this. And also the taxation of Social Security benefits. So if you are collecting benefits and working, some of your benefits could be taxed. And they increased the tax on benefits during my juncture there. So anyway, it was my job to look at a bill and say, okay, to analyze it, here's how much money this would cost or save the government over a 10-year period if they go with this legislation. And my numbers were often printed in the newspaper. And all along this time, the government was kind enough to give me a little bit of time every day to study for the actuary exams, because at the time I started, I was only partially through the exams. And in 1996, I finally finished them. And I spent a lot of my time studying for these things. So suddenly I had all this extra time, which, as I mentioned before, that's how I got started into studying gambling after I finished the actuary exams. And I know the original question was about baby names. Sorry to take so long to get to it. But my wife and I learned that we were expecting in 1996. And being a Michael, I did not want to give my kid a common name, because all through my childhood, there were always two or three other Michaels in every class, and the teacher called on Mike, and everyone had to say which one. And I definitely did not like having such a common name. So I had access to great Social Security data, and it was not difficult for me to run a query against the most recent Social Security card applications to see what people were naming their kids. And so I did this, and I thought, wow, I bet I'm the first eyeballs to ever see this list of the most popular baby names for, it would have been 1996.
Remind me, do you get a Social Security card at birth or when you're like starting the workforce at 15 or 16?
When I remember my mother taking me to get a Social Security card when I was probably about 16. But now they're given at birth if you want it. And I think that almost every mother opts to do this. Is the hospital staff will come at you with their application form and say, fill this out, and I see no reason not to, because everyone's going to need one eventually, and it just people ask for it now for kids at a very young age. So so I don't think that we're missing very many births right. because of this. So yeah, so anyway, I looked at this and I thought, this is great stuff. I bet lots of other people out there would like this. So I put it out there on my website, and somehow other websites that had more to do with pregnancy and early childhood found this and thought, oh, may we put this list on our own site? And I said, sure, you know, just give me proper credit. And
this is 97. The internet wasn't mm-hmm. near what it is today.
Exactly. I don't know. But still.
Was Google around?
I don't think so.
It'd be hard to find that.
So yeah, I think I only started hearing about Google, 10 years ago or so.
Yeah.
Anyway, so basically it took on a life of its own. And it became very popular. Every time I updated the list, when a new year of data would come out, I would put it on my website. That would get copied to other websites. Then the news media would catch on to it, and you would see my list published in all the major newspapers, mentioned on the news. One year in particular, I broke it down by state, and I found that the most popular boy's name in California and Texas was Jose. And I thought, wow, this is extremely interesting. And so I broke it down by state, and it showed, yes, for California, Texas, Jose is number one. And this made the front page of the LA Times as well as many other newspapers. So I was quite proud to make the front page of the LA Times, being from the LA area.
Huh, very good. So And I suspect you don't remember the first name in Arizona or the Michigan or whatever.
Well, I bet Jose was not far down in Arizona. Yep. Arizona has a more mature Hispanic population, so they may be a little bit more anglified there. Michigan probably gets the very common, you know, Michael, John, James, Robert kind of names. And by the way, even though I left the agency in 2001, they still keep up this project just because there's enormous public interest in it, and they always update the new lists around Mother's Day.
All right. So on your website, there are several pictures of you standing next to pretty ladies. You seem to enjoy posting those pictures. Why is that?
I like a beautiful girl as much as the next guy, and I like to have a little eye candy on my show. I mean, on my website. So
yeah, but you're in the same picture.
You know, I guess that's just my vanity. Here's a pretty girl. I'm taking pictures of her. I think I'll just ask someone to take one of us together. And and I don't know. Maybe it's the math nerd in me that
does your wife have
that's
any problem
a little bit
with
insecure.
This? Does your wife have a problem with any of this?
I don't know that she's ever seen them. But she knows that I have kind of a weakness around pretty girls and maybe get a little bit flirtatious. But as long as it doesn't go past that, I think that she will let my leash get that long.
All right. So at the gaming show, there's going to be 5 or 10 opportunities this year for you to get your picture taken with some barely dressed women with a pretty face and a heavy shot of silicone. And so are you going to take advantage of some of those opportunities?
Oh, of course. And yeah, many of the girls you see were former Playboy playmates, and lots of times they do photo ops at the gaming show. And one time I was invited to a Super Bowl party at the Palms, and they invited several former bunnies, and that was lots of fun, and I got lots of good pictures out of that experience.
All right. So what do you do in your spare time when you're not getting your picture taken with pretty girls, you're not gambling, and you're not juggling, and you're not unicycling?
I'm into mountain climbing, hiking. We talked about a trip recently where I did Mount San Jacinto and Mount Baldy in preparation for doing Mount Whitney. And I know that these are not way up there on the list of difficult mountains to climb, but last year I'm proud to say that I did Mount Shasta in a single day, which was pretty hard. So I enjoy doing that. I'm into fitness. Usually I'm doing either biking, running, or swimming. Lately I've been on a swimming kick, and I have been trying hard to become fluent in Spanish.
Uh-huh. Now, what was your first gaming experience for stakes that were important to you?
I have been a gambler as long as I can remember. There is just something in the blood that some people just like gambling and some don't. And I'm one of those who do. And they say that I got it from my great-grandfather, who was also a notorious gambler. And I remember...
You're not a notorious gambler. You are a gamer. You're a gambling analyst. But notorious gambler is a guy who has a stogie in his mouth and cards up his sleeve and those kind of things. And that's not you.
I agree. And that's why I said he was a notorious gambler. But I'm definitely not. I'm sure I would be small potatoes next to him. I've never really made a life-changing bet in my life. But, you know, as a kid, one bet that I made a lot is my father put up a basketball hoop in our driveway. And there were a lot of hot shot athletic kids who also had a lot of vanity. And I knew that their percentage was not 50%. They were certainly much better than me, but it was not 50%. So I said, you know, I'll bet you a quarter that you can't make a free throw. And sure enough, you know, they were not going to back down to the challenge. So they would take it, and most of the time I would win. So I think I've always had an eye for looking for good odds in anything. And, you know, we often did just penny-ante poker games and stuff like this. And, you know, I made it, just did it for the fun. It was never really big money involved. So really early on, I think I just like to bet on oddball proposition bets.
Yeah, the first time I remember going out to dinner with Michael, where he, for picking up the check, he wanted to find a bet. So he would want to throw out a bet, keep coming up with situations to ask the waitress as to whether or not she would know. So one of the things was, did I want to bet that the waitress would know what the capital of Nevada was? And so if I thought yes, she would, and he thought no, he wouldn't, well, that would have been the bet, or whichever way it went. And so he kept throwing out ideas, and he finally came to the idea that this wasn't something that I was really into. And so we don't do that anymore. But if you ever want to bet on whether or not your waitress knows the capital of Nevada, go out to dinner with Michael and you will have your opportunity.
Yes, indeed you will, as I like to gamble for checks. And when I'm out with my usual group of friends, we will never, ever just split up a check. Somebody will pay the whole thing. It's just a matter of how are we going to gamble on who does that. And if we can't agree on trivia, then we will probably play liar's poker for it.
I remember one night we went out to for drinks with Elliot Jacobson after a show. And Elliot and Michael were trying to figure out this bet, and they couldn't. So I finally came up with a bet for them, those two, to decide between. And the idea is they had to get the right answer. Or if they came up with the wrong answer first, then the other guy won. And it turned out that they both got the wrong answer, even though they both knew the right answer, but they both got it wrong. And so I thought I should have won, but it didn't work that way. Someday we'll tell that question on the air.
But I like gambling on the final Jeopardy question in just that manner, where two people have to independently write down what they think it is, and if one person gets it and the other person doesn't, then the loser must pay the winner whatever the wager is.
Oh, well, I might be interested in doing that. Although whether you both get it or neither gets it is positively correlated.
I agree, as it is on the show.
So someday we'll talk about my Jeopardy game experience when I was on, and it's an interesting story to tell there.
I will definitely be asking of that when we come down to Plan D in the future, and I'm going to interview you.
Uh-huh. So at this point of the show, Michael, I usually ask you, what did we learn tonight? Now, I'm going to make the wild guess and speculate that you already knew everything that our guest revealed tonight, so I'll have to try to answer the question, what did I learn tonight? And I actually didn't know you were a juggler or a unicyclist. I guess I had read that on your website, but I just didn't really know about that. I started going through and looking at some of the differences between us, and I see myself as more of a gambler than an analyst. I like being a video poker analyst, and I call myself the world's premier video poker writer and teacher, which I think is a fair statement, but I'm more of a gambler or a player than I am an analyst, and I think for you it's the other way around.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So, what's new and different on the Wizard websites?
I finally put up my page on Free Bet Blackjack, which is the blackjack variant at the Golden Nugget, which we talked about in our interview with Jeff Hall. And I also wrote a page on a game called Dragon Tiger, which is one of the easiest games I've ever analyzed. It's a game where the dragon hand gets one card and the tiger hand gets one card, and you bet which one is higher. And there's a little bit of proposition bets as well, but it's kind of like a simplified version of Baccarat. So I hear this game can be played in Cambodia. So running out of games to write about, I wrote about that one.
Now, last week our guest was Stephen Howe, and he had written about Free Bet Blackjack and actually did the math for the game himself. Before you posted yours, did you consult his to make sure you're on the same page, or did you notice any errors in his?
Yes, I did my own analysis using an infinite deck assumption, which makes the math a lot easier. And I found that I did not agree with Steven's strategy that he put in a math report that he gave to Jeff before he published his own page. And I challenged him on this. And I furthermore, I got a third opinion from another gaming analyst who I paid for this myself. And she agreed with me. So I threw the challenge flag, said, Steven, I think you made a mistake. And he admitted that he did. So he redid the strategy. And so I agree with it now. And a lot of my analysis I did get from Steven. For example, the house edge and the effect of some rule changes. So I'm not ashamed to say that the last year or so, I've been leaning on other mathematicians when I write about a game. I figure that if somebody else already did this and the analysis is given to me, you know, why do I need to spend my time reinventing the wheel when I trust the answer that's already out there?
Mm-hmm. Like the IGT math guy, the head guy there is named Chris Bruni, who is very sharp.
I agree. I've never, ever found a mistake in their work. And he is kind enough to share at least the bottom line when it comes to their new products. And often I will ask details about how they came up with the bottom line that are not disclosed in the rules, and he usually won't tell me. But I found IGT to be very forthcoming about the odds of their games. And for that, I think they deserve a kudos.
I agree. And I frequently will go and ask them because I'm going to write about it, and they will send me the information I need to write about it. So that's good. All right. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. In July, every Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday, if you play 200 points between 3 a.m. and 11 p.m., you get to spin the wheel for prizes. Prizes include $20 free play, $50 in free play, 2,500 points, food coupons, 2x points, or a logo t-shirt. Although there is a random element involved, generally speaking, the better your mailer is, the better gifts you get in the wheel spin. To me, the best prize by far is double points, which is good between the time I get the award until midnight. Therefore, I'll do my 200 points of plays relatively early in the day, so if I'm fortunate enough to get that multiplier, which won't happen very often, but if I get it, I'll have time to take advantage of it. On Mondays and Wednesdays, between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m., $1,000 will be randomly given to a player every half hour. At the Palms, the weekly drawings take place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in July. 10 players earn cash each of these nights with a top award of $4,000. You can win once each, basically three times. You can win each of the three nights. For the first 2 weeks in July, the play, earn, and win shifts to 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, where you can earn gift cards. The top-end gift cards, $100 each, are for Apple, TJ Maxx, or Omaha Steaks. There are $50 prizes, $50 gift cards, $25, $15, $10, $5, as well as $3 in free play. The rate on gift cards at the Palms has recently been 40,000 points per $100 in gift cards, which is a rate of 0.25%. This month, it only takes 30,000 points for that same gift card, which is now a rate of 0.33%. which is quite a bit better. In each of the denominations, you only can get one card. So if you want the $100 card, you pick the Apple one or the TJ Maxx one or the Omaha Steaks. You can't earn all three. It takes $67,000 and some change to get one in each denomination. And many people are doing just that. Every day they're playing $67,000 coin in. What this means is the drawings, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you're going to have a lot of players who played $67,000 every day. And so if you've played a lot less than that or didn't heavily go for it, your chances to win in this month's drawing are less than they usually are. On Sundays in July, they have a swipe your card giveaway in addition to 2x points for video poker. and 10 times points for slots. At videopoker.com, the free monthly contest always takes place between the 23rd of the month and the end of the month. So that's a couple weeks away. So, and I don't know which of the games is going to be featured in the contest for July. Therefore, let me talk at this time about one of the other videopoker.com games. The game I want to talk about tonight is called Good Times Pay Poker. This is a triple play game with added excitement. You may bet 5 coins per line, which is standard triple play. You also may bet 6 coins, 7 coins, 8 coins, 9 coins, or 10 coins per line and get random multipliers. The multipliers are random and they are exactly fair, meaning that if you're betting 7 coins per line, the average multiplier is 1.4. If you're betting 10 coins per line, the average multiplier is 2. Each line of the game gets its own multiplier, although sometimes two or more lines can end up with identical value multipliers. The return of the game is not affected by the multipliers. So like 9-6 jacks or better, good times pay poker returns 99.54% if you know how to play it well. Whether you're betting a total of 15 coins, 18, 21, 24, 27, or 30 coins. At any particular casino, it's possible that there is a better pay schedule on the Good Times Pay Poker machine than on the regular video poker machine. Therefore, when you're checking out the games in a casino, you should check Good Times Pay just in case. The game is a bit slower than triple play, and the sound effects are different. Whether these things are good or bad is a decision you're going to need to make for yourself. All right.
I think that Super Times Pay is also worth checking. Lots of times it just will have the identical game to whatever you're playing, but that offers a little bit higher return.
It does. It's almost a quarter of a percent higher. The strategy is not affected by it. And it's Super Times Pay is always a 6 coin per line game. Our guest next week will be low-limit poker expert Ed Miller, discussing his new book called Playing the Player. Now, Shaq is going to be headed for the hills next week, climbing Mount Whitney to play backgammon. So my co-host will be Arnold Snyder, which, as co-host goes, not too shabby. Now, in Snyder's poker books, he addresses playing the player, but Snyder is talking about tournament play, and Miller is talking about ring play. So they come to different conclusions. So part of what we're going to do is I have a list of questions to ask them as to why they're different in ring play versus tournament play. And I'm expecting we're all going to learn something. So I expect that to be educational. So, actually, I suspect you would enjoy hearing the show, so I recommend you listen to it on your website after you get back in town.
I absolutely will, and looking forward to it.
All right. Now, next week, I'll be starting a new semester of free video poker classes at Samstown. They'll be on Tuesday afternoon, beginning at 1 p.m. in the Red Rock Room, which is upstairs right next to the overpass from Parking Garage 1. All right. Right now, we have gone through the menu of everything there is to talk about. So, Michael, what else didn't we ask you today that you think that as go back to being a guest, what else should I have asked you that I failed to ask you?
I think we covered me pretty well. One, maybe in my hobbies, I should have mentioned that I love games. I don't necessarily have to gamble on them. And I take games very seriously, whether it be chess or Risk or Monopoly or the Settlers of Catan. When I sit down to play a game, I give it my best shot. And when I play my kids, I don't go easy on them. That game is in front of me. I'm doing everything I can to win. But lest you say I'm a terrible father, I will give my kids a handicap of some kind, usually, if I can. If it's a game like Connect Four, there's not much you can do except to let them go first.
But in chess, you could give them a queen, a rook, and a bishop, and they would do all right against you.
Yes, and I would probably have to give them that much. Unfortunately, none of my kids have picked up my interest in chess. That's another game that I was really addicted to at various points in my life. When I was a kid, I had an Atari 2600, and I had the chess cartridge for that. And every day after school, I would spend hours playing chess against this machine. And I remember that it took like 5 minutes for the game to make a move, which is crazy compared to how fast computers are today. And so that's another interest of mine. I don't gamble as much as I used to. When I first moved to town, I gambled quite a bit, but I don't do the tournament thing as much anymore because I'm, believe it or not, I'm not invited to as many as I used to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect the Venetian to invite you to any of their tournaments.
You know, when I was interviewing there, I said, you know, just out of curiosity, can you pull up my account? I just want to see if there's any notes about me. And they did, and there weren't any. And that's what I was expecting, is I'm still a clean, good player at the Venetian, and I won a craps tournament there. But I think that I only played two tournaments there, so they didn't have a whole lot of information about me to form any negative opinions.
Uh-huh. So if they invited you again, you'd probably take off your name tag before you you played?
I wouldn't mind, but any casino employee in the city is probably not allowed to play at their own casino, including me.
Yeah, I'm sure. When I teach classes at Sam's Town or South Point, I still play and enter the drawings and stuff like that. There have been players last year at Sam's Town who were very upset that I would enter drawings while I was teaching classes, because as far as they were concerned, I was an employee. So finally the slot director said it would be a whole lot easier on him if I just didn't enter any drawings until I stopped teaching the classes there. And given that I wanted to teach again this year, I had to say yes last year.
That must have been a tough choice.
Well, I mean, it's not that tough, but the drawings are positive EV over there, so I thought that was pretty good. Now, Sudoku is a kind of a mathematical puzzle thing. It's not gambling, but the same kind of skills that teach you that you can do a that would have you be a good gambler could be used to solve the Sudoku puzzles. So is that something you enjoy doing?
Yes, of course. I'm into Sudoku. I will always carry a Sudoku book with me when I go on a flight anywhere. I think it's a great time killer. I tend to not just sit down at home and go through a Sudoku very often at home because there's usually so many other things that I've got to get done. But when you're killing time, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I do too. The ones I'm enjoying the most now are called the Extreme, which have the X in the middle, where you also get an extra way to do it there. So it's a whole new strategy. But anyway, go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Okay, good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.